The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Thursdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. Welcome to News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. .com. You can call in at 877-627-5065. That number again, 877-627-5065. Just a little thought provoked by the commentary you just heard by my friend Matt Rothschild of the Progressive Magazine. He mentioned, he was talking about the South Korean, you know, and U.S. military exercises because of the so-called sinking by North Korea of the ship. I say so-called because one independent probe has found that there is no evidence of the ship actually being penetrated by a torpedo. So there's information there we just don't know, but this is very important. China has now staged a large-scale military exercise on its east coast, just as South Korea and the U.S. conduct their own major naval drill. Artillery troops of the Nanjing Military Region, responsible for defending the nation's eastern seaboard, is conducting live ammunition exercises near the Yellow Sea. So China's not too happy about this, and this exercise seems to be having the effect of destabilizing the region. I won't be talking more about it, but I just wanted you to know about it because you just heard about this exercise between South Korea and the United States. Here on News Dissector Radio today, we'll be talking about WikiLeaks. We'll be talking about the Netroots Nation conference that just took place in Las Vegas, and we'll be talking about the economy with Aaron Crown of ml-implode.com, one of the most authoritative financial blogging sites on the internet. So stay with me, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops.
Then bank walking to AAA. Grandpa knows it's 401k.
Thank you. Listening to Polarity One's theme song for my documentary Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. And that's actually the voice of Bernard Madoff embedded in that musical collage. That's the theme of the documentary, now out on DVD from This Info. We'll tell you how you can get hold of it in a bit. Right now, the biggest story, one of the biggest stories in the world, WikiLeaks, the dumping of some 90,000 plus documents or digital files on the public through three major newspapers, The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel, an effort to bring information about the war from the people who are waging the war, the actual soldiers in terms of their incident reports and other documents that have been classified secret, although they keep pointing out that secret is not the highest classification of secrecy. So it's not clear that this has harmed anyone in the field, although Republicans are now calling for a prosecution under the Espionage Act against the WikiLeaks website and its founder. So these are some new developments today, and this is an important breaking continuing story. I thought about who best to talk about it, who would know the best about it. I try to reach WikiLeaks, a little difficult since every news media outlet in the world wants to get to them and get them on, and I unfortunately do not have the clout yet. and this is going to shock you, of the Today program on NBC. The audience, our audience, a little smaller. So, you know, we haven't been able to reach him yet. We might still. I know him. I know a little bit about WikiLeaks going back from before it was founded, which I can share with you if you call us. I'm told that the new number I gave you is actually the old number. The real number is this one. Write this down. Embed it in your brain. 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. And if you live in New Jersey, you don't have to call collect. You can just dial this dial-free number and you'll get through to me. At any rate, the person I thought could bring the most to this discussion, because he can bring the most historical perspective about leaking and about war and about the disclosure of information going back to the Pentagon Papers, is a journalist, Gareth Porter, who's been for years covering these events. He's one of the few who covered Vietnam and is now covering Afghanistan with the same tenacity, the same insight, the same investigative honing in on what's really happening. Gareth Porter's in Virginia. He's joining us this morning. Welcome to the program, Gareth. I thank you for coming on.
Good morning, Danny. Thanks very much for having me on.
You know, because obviously both of us go back to the Vietnam War days, to the coverage of the Pentagon Papers, to their release, to the impact, which was, you know, to try to prosecute Daniel Ellsberg, Tony Russo, but not necessarily to do anything about the war, which went on until 1975, when the Vietnamese actually put us out of our misery by ending the war themselves through a military victory in South Vietnam. But right now, this WikiLeaks disclosure is causing ripples because it raises so many questions, A, about the conduct of the war, the brutality of it, the killings of civilians, B, the relationship and role of Pakistan, and whether or not Pakistan has actually been supporting the Taliban. And three, you know, also the whole role of the Afghan government, which has now weighed in with a denunciation of WikiLeaks. President Karzai called it shocking and implied it's dangerous to Afghan informants. In a statement from Kabul this morning, he said that the disclosure is extremely irresponsible and shocking. I mean, in a war in which people are routinely massacred, the fact that some information has been disclosed is hardly on the same level of being shocking, but there it is to the president, so-called president of Afghanistan, since there is some question about how much of Afghanistan he really presides over. But nevertheless, we're in a situation where these disclosures, and the fourth impact of them, I think, is on the news media itself. Here was WikiLeaks disclosing information about the war from the inside that our media basically has not reported, although they're claiming to have. So there's a lot to talk about here. Gareth Porter, what is your perspective when you heard about this WikiLeaks disclosure? What went through your mind?
Well, of course, as you suggested, the comparison with the Pentagon Papers was one of the first thoughts that I had. And I must say that the contrast between the nature of the documents as well as their relationship to the politically to the war were very, very different. Just to begin with the nature of the collection of documents, the WikiLeaks documents are, it's almost, not almost, it is inaccurate really to use the word leak. It's really more like the entire contents of the sewer being, dumped out on the ground, rather than a leak, which suggests a relatively small sort of drip problem.
I had the same problems with the BP oil spill.
Yes, exactly.
Sort of the language really didn't do justice to the scale of the catastrophe.
The real point about the WikiLeaks Afghanistan war documents is that this is essentially everything that traveled across these encrypted channels, on this particular, at this particular level of secrecy. so that, you know, there's no effort here.
Let's tell people what they are. I mean, these are digital files, for one thing. Second, so they're not like hard documents.
They're not historical studies
like the Pentagon Papers or how we got into the war, you know, in Vietnam. But this is really how the war is being conducted by the people who are conducting it. These are their reports.
It's the complete day-to-day record of everything that happened that is reported at that level of secrecy. Now, again, this does not include the very high, you know, sort of top secret levels of communications at higher levels of command, you know, within the command itself and between the command and Washington. And this, of course, is in very sharp contrast to the kinds of documents that we saw in the Pentagon Papers, which were essentially those very high-level policy-related and diplomatic or sort of political relations between the U.S. Embassy and Washington policymakers documents. And so there's a very, very sharp contrast between the level of the secrecy and of the kind of events that are being chronicled in the documents, as well as the origins of the documents. Remember that the Pentagon Papers were the result of a decision by Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara to have a study done for the purpose of learning lessons from the past and to apply them to a war that was still going on. So that, you know, this was, there were two parts of it. One, of course, was the history of Vietnam policymaking, which was done by a team headed by Leslie Gelb, hardly a dove, hardly somebody who was anti-war. He later on went on to write a book which justified the Vietnam War and which was famous in its reassurance of the American people that everything is fine, that the policymaking system works just great, and we achieved exactly what we wanted to do.
Let's just forget to remind our listeners that Mr. Gelb became an editor of the New York Times.
That's right.
And was
later,
very involved in the coverage of conflicts and then became the head of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, here we had this small circle of media bigs and foreign policy wonks working together. And even in this case, the New York Times scurried itself over to the White House to try to, you know, show them, tell them about the documents and show them how responsible they were going to be, and they got patted on the head by the White House, reportedly, you know, for being the good boys to come on over and say that. The Guardian in England and Der Spiegel did not do anything similar to that.
Right, and so the history itself was you know, rather misleading in many ways, very, very much biased in favor of the U.S. war itself, rather than a very accurate history of the policymaking on Vietnam. Nevertheless, of course, there are many things about it that were useful for opponents of the war to pick out and really create their own alternate narrative about Vietnam. But then the second part of the Pentagon Papers were the raw documents themselves, and there you had you know, what could be legitimately called a treasure trove, in the sense that there were so many things that were important in pointing out the disparity between what had been said publicly and what we now knew at that point from the papers themselves.
Well, I'm sorry for jumping in here, because this is, you know, a subject that I've been very invested in for many years. I was covering Daniel Ellsberg when he was at the federal courthouse in Boston in Foley Square in 1971. A photograph of my hand with my microphone on it actually is the last image in the documentary about Ellsberg that was nominated for an Academy Award. So, and I've chatted with him since about it. So, you know, these are issues that I'm very close to. WikiLeaks is an effort really to get a blast of truth into the media. Their objective here is not just against the war, but also to open up and make available information that is being concealed from the American people through intelligence classification, but also for political reasons, because they don't want us to know about this stuff. And what we have here, to me, was very interesting, is that we're seeing, you know, one of the disclosures here is that there were as many casualties on a sort of day-by-day basis in Afghanistan as in the big incidents that we've seen covered in the news, you know, the bombings, the drones attacking, wiping out families, and, you know, quote, oops, made a mistake, here's some compensation. What they're saying was this was routine. It would happen every single day.
Yes, and this is something that McChrystal, when he was still commander there, actually commented on himself. Quite astonishingly, he admitted that the numbers of ordinary Afghans who were being killed, not in battlefield situations at all, but in sort of ordinary sort of traffic related incidents and similar sorts of things, was astounding.
What's interesting, though, to me, and this is, I write about this on my blog, mediachannel.org/blog, newsdissector.com/blog is my actual blog. I have a piece called The United States of Wiki Denial, and it talks about the media coverage, but also how in England and Germany, this question about what happens to civilians was really paramount, something that they were mostly concerned about and focused on, whereas in the United States, you know, the idea, well, people die in war, kind of dismissive attitude, and their focus was more on the foreign policy angle with Pakistan, the use of heat-seeking missiles by the Taliban and the like, anything but the absolute continuing massacre, you have to call it, that's going on there. You know,
Danny, you're absolutely right. I think that's an absolutely key point for Americans to, and particularly progressive Americans, to contemplate, because it does, I think, effectively point to a contrast in the values, really, that animate Europeans in regard to issues of war and peace. And Americans, broadly speaking. I mean, of course,
I would say, though, it's not just Americans don't care. It's that our media doesn't really encourage us to care by reporting this stuff on a regular basis.
Well, I agree with that, too. But I think that there probably is beneath the surface in the population at large a problem here of values. That is to say that, over decades and even centuries, the culture of the United States has hardened this population to a degree that is perhaps different from the cultures of other countries which have been involved in wars.
Well, I think that's shocking. There was just a study that shows that since the founding of these United States of America, there's been a war every 5 years in our history.
Yeah, that
20% of the time that the USA has been alive, you know, USA
yes.
number one, we've been engaged in wars of various kinds. So war is like central to what we do here.
But
somehow.
Danny, before we run out of time, I want to make one point about the WikiLeaks phenomenon, which I haven't had a chance to make yet, and that is that there is something really unprecedented and revolutionary, in a sense, about this phenomenon of what they're doing on the Afghanistan war. And that is that this release of the complete documentation, essentially, although they've held back a few thousand for later release, really, in my mind, sends a message to the war managers and policymakers that they no longer have operational security, and that they need to consider in the future actions that they may be taking on the ground, which have a very good chance of being made public through this kind of release in even shorter time frames than we have had in this case. And so I think it's really effectively a deterrent. I can't document this, obviously, but I think that there is a sense in which this is meant to be a deterrent for future acts of war.
And I also think, you know, what WikiLeaks is saying, you know, they're appealing to veterans to vet these documents and compare them to their own experience. They're saying they're being inundated with more documents now as a result of this leak.
Right.
I mean, this is a sort of counterweight. This is really what journalism was supposed to be, a check on state power, a source of truth and commentary that, you know, really challenges the government's view of things. And we've gone gone so far away from it. Not surprising. Your hometown paper there, the Washington Post, put down WikiLeaks, of course, perhaps because they weren't given the documents. But the newspaper that brought us the Watergate disclosures, you know, have it in the case of the, you know, Iraq war, certainly basically been totally supporting that war in their op-ed commentary and the like. Now we have a situation where, you know, Afghanistan, I mean, they can't say enough bad about it. Today's Wall Street Journal has a front page story about the amount of drug abuse going on inside Afghanistan, you know, with the drug industry as their central export industry. Envoy says corruption helps Taliban win recruits.
Right.
Who said that? Richard Holbrooke. And, you know, in other words, it's very hard to conceal how terrible the situation is. And so the Republicans now are trying to divert attention by calling for an espionage prosecution against WikiLeaks. Mr. Kyle has called for this. Mr. Graham has called for this. They should be prosecuted. So far, the government says it's investigating, but this story is not over yet, is it, Gareth?
It is not over, and I must say you're absolutely right that this is a kind of political diversion, and it's really an act of desperation. And I'll tell you why I think that this can be said with great confidence. This war, I've been saying for the last 3 or 4 months, is on political life support. It is a war that is has reached the point that the Iraq War had reached in 2006, where political support, and I'm not talking now about public opinion, because both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, public opinion had turned against majority views had turned against the war some time ago. But what I'm talking about is the collapse of political support within the political elite itself, and particularly the national security elite. You know, you've had dramatic examples in the last week or two of major figures basically jumping ship from the Afghanistan war and saying, we can't win, we can't succeed, we're going to have to pull out of the South and cede it to the Taliban. Maybe we can go up north and work with the old Northern Alliance people. But I mean, this is a stage of sort of the collapse of support for the war, which is very far advanced. And that's why I think the WikiLeaks story is so significant. It's so important because it is occurring in the context in which this war has lost its not just its moral legitimacy, but its political legitimacy in Washington, D.C.
Okay, Gareth, thank you for joining me. There's so much more we can say. I'd like to continue to review this. You know, we've had 100 Democrats, 12 Republicans turn against the war. It's the beginning. It's, you know, they still passed $37 billion in a supplemental appropriation to be poured into that rat hole. But it seems like the tide is turning here. And I think that is going to not necessarily augur well for the Obama administration either.
The tide is turning, but it's going to take many steps, many stages before this is over.
Okay.
That's for sure.
Thanks so much. Gareth Porter. You can read his work on the Internet. He's at IPS. He's a fabulous journalist. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks again, Danny.
We can stay in touch on this. We're moving now to another subject and another person who we're going to talk to for a few minutes, and then we'll take a break and then come back with her. I'm talking about my dissectress, the woman who works with me on the News Dissector blog, who's been very helpful in working with me on the promotion of the film Plunder, who's just come back from Las Vegas for the Netroots Nation conference that brought there some of the bigs in the Democratic Party, in the blogarati, in the elite, among the activists, all in Las Vegas, the town where the Tea Party was going to meet, and they canceled their conference there because of it was too hot or something. I don't know. Sherry Welch, welcome. Sherry, how was it in Vegas?
Oh, I was the mistress of the burning sands. It was hot, but it was exhilarating to talk with so many people who actually pay attention to what's going on and write about it. And they're demanding the change that we voted for.
Well, who was there? I mean, don't say who was not there, okay? Because I wasn't there. Okay.
You weren't there, and you were sorely missed. We had my hero, Congressman Alan Grayson. Al Franken closed it. Van Jones gave the keynote. breakfast meeting, which was very apt, especially in the wake of the Shirley charade, because Van, too, got thrown under the bus. Ed Schultz gave a barn burner, talked about how the White House has a war room, but they also have a sissy room, and he said that he's tired of hearing the Senate say, we don't have the votes, and Ed's attitude was, well, go get them. And then the wonderful governor from Montana, Brian Schweitzer, we had Linda Chavez Johnson, who's running for lieutenant governor. In Texas, the remarkable rock star, Elizabeth Warren, she got a standing ovation. And then Lieutenant Dan Choi brought the whole room, over 2,000 people, to tears because he'd given the moderator with the speech, the interview with Harry Reid, his ring from West Point. Plus, he got arrested in Vegas for stopping traffic for Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Well, so
and,
you had all these luminaries there, but what about, you know, this was the Netroots nation. So how were the Netroots responding to this? What was the sense that you had of the people who were there with you and their interest and their activism? Because obviously, if the Democrats have any prayer of holding on to seats this fall, they're going to have the activist support of the people who are going to be willing to go out and work for them. And there's a lot of disillusionment, you know, among the base.
There is, and the thoughts of Boehner and McConnell being in power scares everybody to death because that will make us yearn for the days of Ken Starr. So there is it, but Van Jones said it really great, and if anybody can, go Google, and it's at Livestream or Ustream, his keynote address, because he said that many of us, myself included, that on November 4th, 2008, we thought we had reached the finish line. No, that's the beginning. And what a lot of us forget is Barack Obama is the man who volunteered to be the captain of the Titanic after it hit the iceberg. And I thought that was a really marvelous talk about, you know, despair is when you're 15 pounds overweight and you eat that donut. When you're walking through the mall and you see all those photographs of people, or you look at the Old Spice commercial man and go, that could be me. And change is when you start going to the gym and don't eat the donuts. So we all have to remember that we went through 8 horrific years, and you don't turn a ship around overnight. Yes, there's things that have been watered down, but I think all of us need to just suck it up, become even more active and dedicated for, what are we, 96 days out? And make certain that we vote for the Democrats, and after we get them back and we hold on to as much as possible the House and the Senate, then we start really making our voices heard. In fact, there's a march on Washington that was the huge thing, October 2nd, and it's a march for jobs. And so, did you know that one wind turbine has 8,000 pieces in it, Danny?
One what?
One wind turbine has 8,000 components. How many people will that put back to work?
Well, obviously, you know, we're not getting a lot of job creation going on right now, and we need it badly. There's no jobs bill. The Republicans have managed, through their strategy of just say no, to block, you know, a lot of the initiatives that are needed. And, you know, we're in a situation where even if they didn't, the economy, the structural and systemic problems of the economy are so deep and so difficult that it's unlikely that somebody can just wave a magic wand over this. Even to get a program going, let's say it passes today, by the time it's implemented, we're a year away because of bureaucracy, because of appropriations, because of a lot of other issues. So you're right, we need a certain level of patience. On the other hand, we need a certain amount of relentless determination, and maybe that's what's lacking. One of the things that did happen at Netroots Nation was the screening of the film Plunder. My film was one of those that was shown in part there. What was the response?
They loved it. We got tremendous applause, and people were in shock to discover that, you know, when 5,000 people make a bad decision, you know, the old, what it saw about how all these people bought houses that they couldn't afford. No, when 10 million, 14 million people have made that same bad decision, that's targeted. And so that was a huge talk at the conference. In fact, Elizabeth Warren sat in on a panel about the forgotten foreclosure crisis and how hemp has not been successful. And one of the nice things they did on that panel is they asked everybody in the audience for solutions. So your film went over well, and I can't urge people enough to form a chapter called Screening Liberally in your city and start showing these kind of films like yours, because they're really, your film isn't the only one. There is a concentrated effort to not show films like this so that nobody has to pay attention. I mean, come on, Danny. 2 years, nearly, September 15th, there hasn't been one investigation into this economic meltdown. We need and must call for and demand PCORA Commission-style hearings. It is imperative.
Well, one of the things you might want to do if you're listening, want to know a little bit more, go to plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. That's the website for the film Plunder the Crime of Our Time. Sherry, stay with me. We're going to be back in a minute with more on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com. Phone number 888-874-4888.
I pledge allegiance to the card of the United States of Credit. One nation under debt, with bankruptcies, late fees, and high interest for all.
We're doomed to shop till we drop.
Shopping is the American addiction. Borrowing and debt.
In debt, we trust.
It's kind of hard to serve the master and MasterCard.
Just need your signature right here, please.
The gospel of shopping. The gospel of buying things.
Our society has been really set up to keep us struggling and not give us relief.
In debt, we trust.
The national savings rate.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent news.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and B.
And that was the theme of my earlier film, In Debt We Trust, the In Debt We Trust anthem, calling attention to the debt crisis in America, not just about the government, but about we the people who are also being turned into serfs because of all this debt. Sherry Welsh is with me. She's from Atlanta. Aaron Crown is with me from ml-implode.com, one of the best websites on the internet. If you want to find a diverse source of articles and information about how our economy is imploding in many ways, and we'll come to you in a minute, Aaron. But Sherry, just on a final point, I want you to meet Aaron. Are you there?
Hello, Aaron.
Hi, good to meet you.
You guys live in Atlanta. You should meet each other. But here's the thing. Sherry was just at the Netroots Nation conference. Elizabeth Warren spoke. There was a lot of talk there about foreclosures, maybe one of the first so-called progressive conferences that have actually focused on this issue. Do you see this issue, Aaron, Sherry, becoming more of a major issue as we move into the election season?
I believe so. I mean, the problem hasn't gone away, and the can has been kicked, so the forces are still there. And there was a great chart in the last few weeks going around which compared the mortgage debt outstanding to real estate values, residential real estate values, and while real estate values had fallen significantly, the debt had not. And so that has just piled more distress on the consumer and the residential borrower. So I do think it's going to continue to be a major factor.
Absolutely, Danny. Take Las Vegas alone. 65% of that city's mortgages are all underwater. Vegas has always weathered every economic storm until now. I think they have the unemployment rate. You should have seen how empty the casinos were, and I lived there for 5 years. And it was unbelievable, the stories that you would hear about what's going on with people. There's one man who lives in the neighborhood, and he is the only person left that lives there out of 300 homes, all foreclosed. And they're just sitting empty.
So, I mean, where does this take us? How do you see us coming out of this? I mean, you mentioned earlier, Sherry, that the HEMP, that's the president's program on mortgage relief or mortgage assistance, has not really reached that many people. It's not really been very effective. What can be done, Aaron? What do you see as some sort of resolution here? Because clearly mortgage modifications has been proposed and is being tried. And, you know, just NACA, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, was just in Washington, D.C. at the convention center for a week. It was packed with people in distress. But, you know, is there any light at the end of this tunnel?
Well, there can be. I mean, there really can be. It's very simple. This has had to be done in past crises, like the S&L crisis, but the loans have to be marked to something closer to a more reasonable market value. And, you know, centrally, that is residential real estate homes. And the banks need to mark those down. Some major banks will go bankrupt, should go bankrupt, but that's not the end of the world. I mean, the government has a process for resolving commercial banks that have become insolvent, and I suggest they use it, even on big banks.
Excuse me to break in here for a moment, but remind me now, in the aftermath of the S&L crisis, they set up some sort of a resolution trust authority to resolve the crisis. And, you know, not only did 1,500 bankers go to jail, but there was, a sort of winding down of a lot of those problems somehow with government intervention. Why isn't that happening now?
Well, because the banks own Congress?
Pretty much. And the problem is much, much bigger now. So they don't want to do it. They don't want to bite the bullet. And, yeah, they've captured the regulatory system. So essentially the guys that would lose the most are the ones calling the shots.
You know, I've just read that the lobbying, the bank lobbyists are now going and hiring former regulators to work with them. They are recruiting people who've worked in government agencies who were regulators to help them sort of spin the regulations around to their advantage. That seems to be the next stage of this battle over financial reform, as the people who are to be reformed are learning how to resist reform or, you know, turn it around with the help of people who were regulators who are themselves maybe out of work.
Danny, wasn't there something called the prompt corrective action law that got passed after the savings and loan debacle? Bank couldn't meet their fiduciary qualifications. They had to be placed into receivership.
Aaron?
Right. That's a major point, and that was passed to as sort of a never again kind of sentiment on the heels of the SNL crisis, and it mandates that the government has to enact procedures to wind up an insolvent financial institution. And unfortunately, the authorities let the problem get so bad that you would basically have to fire the entire upper level of FDIC's management for doing such a horrible job. So, of course, no one wants to acknowledge that prompt corrective action even exists. And, of course, with the system we have, no outsider is considered as having standing to sue for anything like that, for failure to apply those regulations.
Then the question is thus, if that is the law that is on the books and it was passed in 1991, and I think it's Section 1831-0, then the TARP bailout package effectively was illegal. Is that correct?
I would agree with that. And, you know, there's various aspects of TARP and arbitrary bailouts like AIG that are blatantly illegal. And John Hussman has talked about that as well.
But so, Danny,
who's going to enforce it, you know?
Let's talk one at a time.
How about we the people?
Well, clearly, I mean, what you're pointing to, Sherry, okay, is one more sort of contradiction in this whole, you know, kind of demonic mess here, you know, where laws are on the books that go unenforced, that regulations are being altered or being lobbied to death or changed in various ways or brought into the courts, finding judges who they know will support whatever business wants and changing, kind of blunting the impact of regulation. We've seen that with the Supreme Court, and we're also seeing it at the state level in many instances. So is there any hope here for real relief for the people, you know, in this country? I mean, this is what people are asking for. Help. We are in trouble. We are sinking. It's not just homes that are underwater. We're sinking. We're drowning. This is the message, you know, you get when you talk to people who are in this kind of distress. And these people are not your basic homeless. These are upwardly mobile, you know, people who bought homes, who are starting, you know, life over again or trying to build a middle-class lifestyle and finding themselves, you know, in a trap of downward mobility and with no good options. And this is something that's really scary. And maybe because it is complicated, nobody wants to pay attention to it. I don't get it. But it's obviously the housing bubble was the center of the whole financial collapse, and yet this issue is still with us with so little done about it. Aaron, I mean, what does that say to you?
Well, it's the system has a lot of momentum, and everyday citizens certainly wanted to believe that it was all okay and all solvent and all that wealth was really there, and I think that that's a part of why there's still a push to try to keep the decrepit system going, is everybody's retirement funds and pension funds are tied up in that same system. But we'll all certainly have to acknowledge reality, and the banks probably more than any other party. So I think average citizens have the most to gain from acknowledging that reality. But it all certainly starts with getting educated and pulling away from the mainstream infotainment propaganda news sources and figuring out what really was going on and what you can do personally in your financial situation to bring yourself relief. And even for some people, that might mean that it's more wise to walk away from their mortgage. For some people, it might mean going through one or more various processes of debt workout, calling a lawyer to have your particular foreclosure situation looked at, or debt settlement on your credit cards, cutting up your credit cards. You know, there are things that we all can do practically to start moving forward.
And Sherry, when you were at the Netroots Nation conference and Elizabeth Warren was there, what was the mood? You know, I mean, do people seem more open to recognizing that this is an issue they have to address? I mean, it may be because, you know, people who are activists, you know, maybe they live in cities, maybe they live in apartments, they don't have the burdens of home and the burdens of home ownership to worry about. That's their parents' generation or what have you. What do you think it is here that has kept people from engaging on this issue, and what do you think might change that?
I think that there is a sense of hopelessness right now. And again, it really goes back to so many of us became disappointed because we really thought we had reached the finish line. No. In your film that you did, Barack Obama's president, that's not the right title, but...
People's President.
The People's President. Thank you, Danny. And FDR, everybody would come to him and say, we need to do this, we need that. And he would say, that's great, now make me do it. And that's what we need to do. And I'm advocating that people write your congressmen, write your senators, hold screenings of plunder, and go take to the streets. Organize, show up in Washington en masse, because having a march for jobs, but the reason we're having that is because of the economic meltdown, which is tied to the mortgage crisis that so few people understand. They don't really understand what happened. And in your film, Nomi Prinz makes a good point that there was $14 trillion worth of, and I don't have the word right, portfolio.
Asset-backed securities.
Asset-backed securities that they leveraged 30 times over, which is $140 trillion.
Right.
And Goldman Sachs just got a slap on the hand for their Abacus Fund for $550 million when that was 2 weeks' worth of income. And how incredibly boneheaded of the SEC not to realize the value of a public trial, what that would do for the people. The biggest thing I came away with is the sense of injustice. Wall Street's back almost 2 years later, bigger bonuses ever before. Yeah. They're doing the same thing. We're going to... same path, and yet these people have been displaced. Their homes are gone.
You know, Aaron, you started your websites to really track all of this, the banks that imploded, the hedge funds, the whole aspects, the nitty-gritty detail of the financial system, and find various people writing about it and tracking it. You know, do you feel like the financial journalists are doing a better job now in terms of getting on the case here? Are we still in a situation of almost, you know, two tiers of information? The financial bloggers and analysts on the one hand, and the business pages and newspapers and TV shows on the other?
I do think it's two tiers, and I can give them credit for catching up in certain respects. And there are some bright lights out there in the so-called mainstream, like Dylan Radigan and some others. But I would say for the most part, the mainstream media is still 6 months to 2 years behind us.
What? Really? Six months.
And I do. You can see some of these things come on, little insights that get acknowledged that percolate up to the mainstream. 6 months to 2 years later, it's pretty reliable, and it's still going on.
You know, because, I've been following this. Obviously, I'm not an economist. I'm not a professor of economics. I'm not a professor of anything except dissectology. I am... somebody who got into this issue in the hope that it's an issue that could unite people, because across partisan lines, across religious lines, across generational lines, because debt and money is something that, you know, affects all of our lives, and fairness in the economy is very important. And as I got deeper into it, not only did I see a level of criminality, but also a level of indifference and writing about it. It really doesn't do justice to what the issues are. And that's when I sort of discovered your website, if you recall, you know, and began looking at trying to decipher it and decode it to some degree, because I wasn't as familiar as I might have been with some of the language of finance and of the real estate industry and all the rest of it. But as you get into it, you realize this is the nitty-gritty issues that determine people's lives, whether or not they're going to be able to keep their home, whether or not they're going to be able to hold on to their job. I mean, it's very practical. It's not something that's vague or minutia. It's central to people's existence.
Right, and you find out that all they've done is take the same folly and the same scams that have been going on in political economy and finance for hundreds of years, and they've just dressed it up with new clothes. You know, the emperor has new invisible clothes, but it is the same scam. The emperor still has no actual clothes.
Now, one of the issues you cover, and I know Sherry's interested in this too, you know, 100 bank failures so far this year, is that significant? Is that a significant number? Are we going to be expecting more? Or were these stress tests in Europe honest and accurate about how stable the banking system is there? I mean, those are three questions, but they're kind of related.
Well, you know, the rate is going up, and we have a tally on bankinflow.com, which is one of my sites, that they've exceeded $17 billion in estimated cost to the FDIC this year, which at that rate, there's no way they can pay for it. The FDIC is not solvent, and they're going to blow through their own estimates at this rate. But I think it's significant in that sense of that it's not going in a good direction. Now, in terms of the banks and financial companies that should be resolved in some sort of receivership process, it's minimal. I mean, the big five, you know, the big six, I would say most of them are actually insolvent if they were honest about their books, and those numbers would just blow away.
I mean, I think this is important. I think what you just said is very important. We read about how, you know, the banks are reporting record profits, they're all doing great, and you are saying, wait a minute, look at their accounting, look at what they're actually saying. It's much shakier than that. These institutions are basically insolvent. True?
That is true, and that kind of recession, some bright lights acknowledged that as far back as 2 years ago, that this was shaping up to be a balance sheet recession, which means your major institutions are in the grip of insolvency, which kind of freezes them, and they, to the extent they're propped up, particularly by the government, they become what has been termed zombie institutions. If you have enough zombie institutions, you get a zombie economy, and that Japan has been criticized for being that for decades, and then we just have fallen into the same pattern, the same traps.
Maybe that's why all these vampire films are so popular,
because
of the zombie connection here. But, I mean, you know, Sherry, you've been dealing with your own real estate issues. I mean, it just seems like there's so much pressure on people, you know, sort of kicking the can down. You know, the landlord is getting kicked by the bank, so he's kicking the tenants. You know, we're in a situation of incredible strain. It seems to be getting worse as more and more layoffs occur. You know, we talk about job creation, but we haven't been talking about job destruction, because, you know, in New York, another 250 station people at the subways, they're talking about raising the significant hikes and the bridge and tunnel fares, the transit fares, and all the rest of it. And so the public is going to be squeezed even more. There's talk of
value added tax. Cap and trade, which is also a general tax on the economy, or what it would amount to.
So how do you see that? I mean, do you think that there's...
I think that, Danny...
Is there an out here?
Yes, we need to demand light rail now. And this takes us back to WikiLeaks round circle to the beginning of your show. We have billions of dollars that we can spend every day to kill people, but we don't have any money to spend on our bridges that are falling down, our schools that are crumbling, our roads. You ought to see our roads in Atlanta. They're horrifying. And it is up to the people to demand it. Turn off your TV sets. Quit watching that nonsense and start learning what's going on and use the internet as a tool, as a library.
Well,
I'm serious about this.
On that,
I agree with that wholeheartedly.
And on that note, once again, I want to recommend for those of you who are not in the know to check out ml-implode.com as one source of information about you know, the economy that you're not getting. And Aaron puts together a daily summary of key articles, which he sends out as well. It's easy to sign up for it. It's free. We have to find ways of getting other information out there. In our case, mediachannel.org is still limping along. It's still surviving. I'm still writing. I also do commentaries for Huffington Post and Op-Ed News and Global Research and a lot of other places, trying to write about the economy in a popular way that people can sort of understand that. I'm doing more interviews on various outlets, but, you know, as fate would have it, I seem to be more welcome by television companies in Iran and in Russia than I am in America, you know, which is sort of bizarre to me, since I worked for so many years in American television at CNN and ABC News and the like, but they're not sort of too interested. Hence, I'm on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with you this morning talking about these issues. There will be a URL in my blog tomorrow. I'll be tweeting it out on Dissector Events later today, the URL of this program, so as a podcast that you can share with your friends. You know, if this medium, if programs like this, if websites like Aaron's or ours are to be, you know, have any impact, if films like Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, are to be seen, we can only do so much, the people who create it. We need you as readers, as listeners, as citizens, to take some responsibility and help us get the word out about these outlets, because these outlets are very important, in my opinion. They're offering information and analysis you don't get anywhere else. And unless you take a proactive role, not just be a passive recipient of knowledge, but an active disseminator of knowledge, we're not going to have the impact we need to be having in this time of incredible crisis. So, Danny Schechter, your news dissector here. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you, Aaron, for joining us today. We'll be back again next week at the same time, same station, PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Thanks for listening.
No dough, nothing to show. I'm all night, can't sleep right. My head's tight. Got my food, clothes, books, and it looks like there's holes in my shoes. What to do? My credit.